Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. I had the great pleasure sitting down over a Facebook interview with Steve Kindler, who I love, man. I was turned on to him by the album Jeff Beck Live with Jan Hammer, and he's a killer violinist from Mahavishnu. So he tells me how he got into rock jazz.
Well, I've been very fortunate in having really great teachers. Back when I was coming up in the 70s, it was a different world in terms of the priorities in education that were placed upon the lively arts. And so it was a thriving environment for being able to make music and to be encouraged to make music from an early age, and having the systems in place and the priority people saw the great benefit. It was clear to see the great benefit that exposing children to arts from an early age had on their overall well-being and sense of worth and their ability to learn, all of those things. So yeah, as I say, it was a really wonderful time for me. I had fantastic teachers from an early age. I come from Portland, Oregon. I grew up there in Oregon, West Coast. And I had a teacher there named Rafael Spiro, who was my violin maestro. And he was an old school. He came from Poland. He was a small Jewish old man, sort of. By that time, I think of him, he seemed to me to be a wise, old, venerable sage, sort of a lay rabbi, if you will, and a fantastic teacher and associate concertmaster in Chicago under Fritz Reiner. And I just owe everything to him in terms of tone production and appreciation of the art in general. And a teacher, as you know, can make all the difference. Yeah, I came from a family of instrumentalists. Three brothers and one sister all played instruments, and two of them studied in their time from my same teacher, Mr. Spiro. Yeah, we'd get together and we'd play. We also liked folk music, and my brother George went on to play fiddle and played with David Bromberg for a number of years in David Bromberg's band and toured around. We'd cross paths when I was playing with Jan Hammer on the road here and there. So it was great having siblings who all play, and we could also play string quartets when we'd get together. Dad played piano. There was a lot of music in the house. But also, talk about golden time growing up in the late 60s and those formative years, teenage years in the late 60s and early 70s. There was so much fantastic music. It was just everything from the folk music to the popular music to the progressive rock to the jazz rock. It was all just burning back then, you know, everything. There was so much to listen to and so many bands coming through town. I saw Frank Zappa a couple times when I was a teenager, and Tower of Power, and saw Jethro Tull, and saw Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and of course Mahavishnu Orchestra a couple times when they came through, and that fired me up too by that music, and somehow heard my own destiny in it in a matter of a miraculously short amount of time I was playing with that band. Now, I went from the Beatles when I was young, of course, and never really into the Stones, and then from there, liked Iron Butterfly. Anything that I had listened to that I really liked, of course, Steppenwolf, I remember really digging them when I was young. Tommy James and the Shondells, because, you know, these certain hits would come on the radio and then you would associate those with enjoyable or meaningful or poignant times. And then once I heard Led Zeppelin, I really got into Led Zeppelin. And I didn't know I was going to be playing with Jeff Beck, or the connection there that with Jimmy Page and those guys, and how Led Zeppelin really was a Jeff Beck spinoff. Another thing about Portland is they had a really great youth orchestra there, of which I was a member from the time I was 10 years old, and finally got to be concertmaster. I spent a couple of years as concertmaster, but first year they also had a tremendous scholarship program, and so they were sending people from the orchestra to Aspen and to Santa Barbara and to Interlaken and to Victoria and to Tanglewood and to all these really very well-known and accredited famous summer camps where these great artists would come in the summertime to teach. And I got a scholarship to Tanglewood and went back there, and Tanglewood is in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts. Well, at that time, they had the Shed happening, in the summertime, and the Shed was this huge outdoor venue, and all these bands would come through and play in the Shed, you know. And there was also this place nearby called the Lenox Performing Arts. Mahavishnu Orchestra came there the summer that I was a student at Tanglewood. Didn't go to the show, but I could hear them, and I could hear this violin, you know, echoing through these hills, these rolling hills. I was like, what is that? It blew my mind. And so I got the album Intermounting Flame, which was one of those albums that changed a lot of people's heads around and was very influential and was really astounding. I came back after hearing Intermounting Flame to Portland and was just Mahavishnu fanatic. I hoped one day to perhaps even somehow meet John McLaughlin. In 72 and 73, they came to Portland twice and played in this place called the Paramount Northwest. They had one in Seattle too, and it was an old movie theater. It's still there, like one of those big 2,000 seat movie halls from the 40s and 50s, you know, that we used to go and see movies in. Well, this was a great rock venue. That was where a lot of the bands came to play. And I saw Mahavishnu there a couple of times, and I was completely knocked out. I mean, what can you say? There was nobody who was in anywhere in the same league with John McLaughlin at that time. They were good players. I mean, certainly Dwayne Allman was a great player. Johnny Winter was a great player. But in terms of, you know, even those guys, they were in awe of what they heard coming out of. And Santana, you know, if you like that kind of stuff, that was another group that I was really influenced by. I really liked the feel and the way that was put together and the sound and the songs. And all those guys were completely in awe of John McLaughlin at that time. And that he came out of the Miles Davis School and had all that tradition, the jazz tradition behind him, and that he was fortunate enough to get together with another guy who played with Miles and Billy Cobham, and the sound that they made together. Of course, Billy Cobham was not just a jazz drummer. He was a funk drummer. You know, he played with James Brown for a while.
Yeah, Billy Cobham and John McLaughlin, man, they were a force to be reckoned with. Killer musicians with killer songs. Now he tells me a really interesting story of how he got the gig as violinist in Mahavishnu and meeting John McLaughlin.
My brother, Bob, who played cello, who lived in Hawaii, played with the symphony there, Honolulu Symphony, a classical player, had a girlfriend named Carol Shive. And Carol Shive went back to New York and came through Portland and met me and saw how rabid a Mahavishnu Orchestra fanatic I was, and then went back to New York and happened to meet John McLaughlin. And at that time, in late 1973, when the first Mahavishnu Orchestra was on the rocks because of interpersonal squabbling, and he was thinking of putting a band together, he talked to her, and she said, well, I know this young kid who lives in Portland who knows all your songs, and he loves your music, and he's a really great player, and maybe we should call him up. And so, out of the blue, I had just finished playing the last concert of the year, playing as a violin soloist with the orchestra in town in Portland, and I get this call a couple of weeks before the concert that John McLaughlin wants me to come back and play in the orchestra. I was 18 years old. You know, I'd only left my mother's arms once in my life, and that was to go to Tanglewood. And so to have that happen to a green 18-year-old kid, too green, as a matter of fact, was, it was a dream come true, totally a dream come true. And so I went back there, and it worked out well. Of course, it was very archaic. There was lots of problems with the sound, and they played really loud on stage, of course. Yeah, John was loud, and Narda was loud, and Ralph Armstrong was loud. And so we had some genius devised probably what might have been the very first plexiglass screen that was put up between the string quartet that we cowered behind, that was put up between Michael Baldwin and our anemic little selves. We played using Marcus Berry contact mics, and so the sound was suboptimal. Could have been much better in terms of the sound, but it worked. And I got to meet Jean-Luc, of course, and we established a good friendship. We'd hang out together, and I would ask him questions about stuff, and he gave me some good advice about, lots of good advice, and showed me some things about playing and some of his secrets, which I cherish the memory and cherish the friendship with him. And then in the course of time, once the inter-band squabbles started to happened in that band, and he left, and I got the simultaneously was actually almost a year later. This is another really interesting story. I get a call. I'm in Portland at my sister's house. Early in the morning, we'd spent the night up listening to music, which we did often back then. It was Jan Hammer on the phone, out of the blue. I'd never met him. And he said, well, Jerry Goodman's and I have split up. We're not playing together. I really need a violinist to play in my band. Will you come out and play? Yeah, I was, whoa. yeah, let me think about this for a minute. I don't know, you know? And so it was really amazing and a very high moment. And I said, of course, you know, I've got this tour coming up with Mahavishnu. And he said, well, come out and play. You know, Doug Rauch is in the band and Tony Smith. And so I said, yeah, sure. Well, I'll talk to John about it and come out. And then it wasn't even like an hour later. And the phone rings again. And John McLaughlin is on the line. And he says, so I swear, I could not make this up. And he says, well, Jean-Luc Ponty has left the band. And I would be very disappointed if you weren't able to take over and play as a solo violinist on this next tour. We have a tour coming up with Jeff Beck for a band. And of course, I was completely gobsmacked, flabbergasted, to say the least. And I said, well, it's funny because Jan called, of course. This was early in the morning, like 6 in the morning in Portland. Of course, it was about 9 in the morning in New York, where they both were. Elliot had hipped Jan to me and said, you've got to call this guy. John got word of it, obviously. That must have been. He got word that, because when I told John that, well, Jan Hammer just called me, he goes, well, and then he got very stern with me, and he said, you know, you owe this to me, and started like putting the pressure on me, because there was all of a sudden there was possessiveness kind of came out. You know, I'd been his protege in his band, and his protege, and he put up with a lot of shit for me in that year, being a young guy on the road. And you know, the album Visions of the Emerald Beyond we made, but at that point, Gail Moran, who is Chick Corea's wife, left, as did the violist of the band, Marcia Westbrook, as did Bob Knapp, who was the one of the trumpet players, and Steve Frankovich had left the summer before. And so he pared the band down. He got another saxophone player, Russell Tubbs, the string trio with the viola not there, Carol Shy, my brother's girlfriend, who got me the gig, Phil Hershey, the cellist, and Narada playing drums. He was Narada by that time. And I think he was still Michael Waller by then. I don't think he was Narada yet. And then later on, John contracted Stu Goldberg to play keyboards and Moog. That was a great addition. He was an excellent player. And then the last player to come in was Norma Jean Bell, who was the former alto saxophonist with Stevie Wonder. Because I came back and I did the rehearsals, and then when it came time for me to go up and have a rehearsal with Jan or to meet him and to play, John was not too happy about that. But he let me go up. I went up and played with Jan and Doug Rauch. Doug Rauch is a bass player, and he was one of the many fantastic bass players. Everyone talks about Jaco these days. And Jaco was a really great player, certainly the most influential, but there were so many great players. And Doug Rauch was a fantastic player who got so much from Larry Graham. Of course, Stanley Clark was a great player. Now, Lance Johnson was a great player. Paul Jackson was a great player. And so many fantastic bass players at that time. And so that tour happened, and there was a break, a two-week break in the middle of it, and Jan asked me to come back and play on his album, The First 7 Days. And so I played on First 7 Days during that break, and at that point I realized that I really wanted to go with those guys. It was a small band, and there was more opportunity to play, and I really loved Doug and Tony, and Jan really wanted me to play in the band with those guys. So I went back and told John that at the end of the tour I was going to join Jan's band and play the rest of the tour with him. So, and that's the way that worked. The tour finished, and he disbanded the band and kept Stu Goldberg and Ralph and Narda, and they became the new Mahavishnu Orchestra for a while, for a couple tours. And when I got back to start the rehearsing with Mahavishnu at SIR on 52nd Street in Manhattan, New York, like the second or third day that we were rehearsing, Joseph, John's manager, comes in and said, there's this guy who's, John, he's hitched all the way from Miami. He's all disheveled. He looks terrible. And he smells like he's been awake for a couple of days. And he says, he has to see you. John said, well, you know, let him come in. And he goes, And he did look like not so well, like he really needed to have a nice rest and a shower. And his hair was all matted and funky. And he said, "You just got to let me play. I hitchhiked all the way from Miami so that I could play with you. I've got to play with your band. You've got to let me play with your band." And Ralph is, of course, Ralph Armstrong is standing right there. And John said, "Well, let him just play a little bit, Ralph, will you?" And so very reluctantly, Ralph hands over his P bass to this motley, disheveled, you know, guy who just wandered in off the street, you know, sort of semi-ravenous, you know, drooling guy, and walks out of the room, you know, with this look on his face like, "Oh my, what am I doing here?" And so the guy puts on the bass and starts to play, and then Michael gets on the drums and John starts playing, and they have that, you know, the guy can play, you know, he sounds like he's good, you know. And I come in and I listen to him, I'm sitting there in my violin chair and listening to him play and looking at him, and you know, he was definitely playing it down. And John said, "You know, I really like the way you play, it's really good to meet you, but I'm sorry, I have a bass player already. You know, Ralph's my bass player." And so Ralph sort of breathes a sigh of relief, you know. "But here, it's $100. At least you can get a hotel room." And so that was it. The guy left. Well, it turns out that guy was Jaco Pastorius. Just think for a minute. I mean, Ralph was a great player. Think what that band would have been like with Jaco on the bass. I met Jaco years later, a couple of years before he died in 84, 85, I was on the road and I was playing at this place called the Lone Star Cafe down in Manhattan. It was the place with the giant iguana on the roof. Remember that place? So here I'm at the Lone Star Cafe and I'm playing with this band called Shadowfax, and Jaco comes in, right? We have a couple sets, and at the end of one set, Chuck leans over to the bass player and said, "Hey man, look, there's Jaco. He's sitting at the bar." And Phil, the bass player, said, "I know." He sort of shook his head and said, "I know," and didn't have a very happy look on his face. One of them goes up to talk to Jaco, right? I haven't talked to him yet. And then comes back to Phil and says, "So Jaco wants to know if he can sit in." And Phil says, "No, no way." But anyway, I went up to him and I said, "Hey man, do you remember me?" Of course, he didn't remember me. I said, "I'm one of the guys who played the Mahavishnu that day you came in. You remember you came in?" He goes, "Oh, man." And then he got this look and he says, "I hitched all the way from Miami. I had to get this bus. You just all that way to arrive 2 days later, whatever." I said, "Don't you remember John gave you that 100? He goes, "Yes." And I gave it back to him. It was not months after that encounter, it's SIR, that Jaco got the gig with Weather Report. And then from there, it was like he was a rocket, you know. Well, the other thing is that he had not only was a great player, but he was also a great musician. He was a composer, great composer. He had harmonic sense. He had really had a very Renaissance approach to jazz music. And so he certainly deserved it. He didn't deserve the shakes he got at the end, though. But you know, that's what comes with being a rock star. You know, you live hard and you die young.
Yeah, I know. It is a sad story with Jaco. Jaco, I used to see all the time around New York City in the Village back in the 80s, and it was very sad. He was a mere shadow of what he used to be. Now he tells me how he got hooked up with Jan Hammer and toured with Jeff Beck.
But I did two albums with him and then had enough of that and went on from there. And then there was another one called Melodies. But Jan was going more toward a pop thing. He sort of got an idea of what it was playing with Jeff to make a lot of money and to be famous and to play popular music, and didn't want to play cerebral, fast, odd time signature jazz rock anymore. He wanted to play stuff that would appeal to more people, that would have a wider audience. And he did. It wasn't his albums weren't that successful, but once he got hooked up and did Miami Vice, then he, you know, that was his gravy train. Yeah, well, I got to know Jeff on that tour with Mahavishnu, and that I was playing with Mahavishnu, and I got this gig with Jan. I was going to go and play in Jan's band. It made me sort of the flavor of the hour. So Jeff and I became really close friends. I went out to his house, and he took me around in his private plane, and I didn't know, you know, I wasn't into the Yardbirds, and I didn't know any of the rock and roll hierarchy, you know, the elite. I just dug Jeff as a friend, as a guy, and I think he really liked that I wasn't, I didn't have any of this hero worship stuff, and it would just be myself. And so we sort of met eye to eye, as it were. And he was playing with Bernard Purdy, and who was really a cool guy too. And it was a really nice tour. There was lots of great friendships that were forged during that tour. And Jeff really was interested in meeting Jan and, you know, doing work with Jan. And so I was sort of a pathway for that to happen too, which was really nice. Jeff's a great player, you know, has such a great sound. And even back then, I mean, seems like he's gotten better and better. He's kept working at it and kept being really devoted to the guitar and still innovating after all these years. So great privilege to have that time to play with him and be friends and hang out. And of course, he was really into Monty Python as I was. And so we spent a lot of time quoting Monty Python and joking that way with each other. And so that was lots of fun. Jan was just starting out. And so we were playing smaller places with Jan, but the music was really great. But we were playing places like my father's place in Roslyn out on Long Island and smaller venues around the East Coast at that time. So, you know, in the trenches, sort of paying dues. But the time came around that it was the opportunity arose for Jan and Jeff to get together, and sparks flew, as it were. And so that led into a couple of years of Jeff Beck with the Jan Hammer Group. Jeff held his own too. You know, he really knew how to make it work. He had a lot of great ideas, and, you know, people go up and down on the road. That's the thing, is, you know, night to night, inspiration comes, it flows, you know. But a lot of the time he was just excelling himself on a nightly basis. Jan was a very consistent player. Like Jean-Luc, they were consistent. They would never fall below a certain level. And oftentimes they would just leave you scratching your head in wonder and amazement and bliss. That was one reason why I wasn't really happy with that band, is that Jan had this idea that he really wanted to have a clean violin sound. And I tried to bring all this stuff in. I tried to bring Mutron biphases in, and I tried to bring ring modulators in, and I tried to bring this fuzz box and this big muff and this, you know, wah-wah pedal and whatever it was. And Jan just kept saying, nope, 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 I want the clean sound. And so all I ran through, I had G&K, Gallium Kruger, amplifier, bass amplifier, and some acoustic bottom with the horn and 215s. MXR, that was making all these really fancy little gadgets at that time, had this 10-band graphic EQ, which we leveled out with a really nice frequency analyzer, which was also a really fancy little gadget back then. Of course, all this stuff is obsolescent and sort of laughable at this point, but that gave a really good violin sound, barely bare bones. I turned up really loud, of course, made it sound a lot better. At that point, Jan was already making a crossover into what I consider to be really inferior pop music, to be honest. I wasn't into it. No, he was doing, you know, sort of funk music and straight ballads and trying to get radio hits, which, you know, that's fine, but there was no place for me in that music. And so I walked. I was feeling more and more not really with the band or with the direction. So I had been on the road by that time for 4 years straight, going from Mahavishnu to Jan to Jeff Beck. And then once Jeff folded back with Jan, I was just not into it. So but at that point, I left and went back into shedding, you know, trying to put into practice a lot of the stuff that I'd learned, because frankly, honestly, I wasn't really, looking back and listening back, I wasn't as good as the musicians that were around me, and I hadn't had the time or the opportunity to really put into practice a lot of what I've learned from these people. For example, John would say to me when I talked to him about improvising, he said, just, you know, just play from your heart. Just forget everything that you know and play from your heart like Coltrane did, you know, like Coltrane did. Oh, man. Yeah, right. And then, but Jean-Luc would say, on the other hand, he said, and I'd say, Jean-Luc, how do you do it? How do I start? What do I do? How do I play like you? I want to play like you. And he said, well, what you have to do is do like I did. Go and get all the Charlie Parker records that there are and put them on the turntable and slow it down. You know, they're 78s or whatever they are. Slow them down to 45 or to 33 and cop those exact licks, those exact Charlie Parker licks. That's the way I started out. I learned every single Charlie Parker lick that I could get my hands on. And what could be more complete opposite from the advice that I was being given by John than go get Charlie Parker records and memorize them? What did I do? I followed John's advice and just played from the heart, and, you know, because it was so much easier. It wasn't any sort of a regimen involved. There wasn't any sort of serious shedding. It was the easy way. Just play what's in your heart and don't try and play like anybody else. Be yourself. But if I'd followed Jean-Luc's advice, I would have ended up a much better player and I would have had a lot more success in music, because that was the lexicon. Charlie Parker was the lexicon. That would have given me the bridge to play more traditional jazz music, which would have given me more gigs. Because Blow by Blow had been so big, and because Wire took off, but even though that wasn't released until we were in the middle of the first tour, we were playing and got a reputation as being a really hot act right off the bat, Jeff and Jan together. And so we got all these gigs playing in these festivals, and Bill Graham had us come down. We played A Day on the Green down there, and we were opening up for all the biggest name acts going out at that time. We opened up a string of dates with Aerosmith, got to hang out with Joe Perry and go out to his house in Boston. We played a gig in Boston opening up for Aerosmith, you know. You can just imagine, let your imagination run wild with that shit for a while. And then we had a bunch of gigs opening up for Fleetwood Mac right when Rumours was peaking. And so, you know, it's no wonder that Jan got seduced by the dark side and left jazz rock and went into pop, because he definitely got a really good eyeful of pop music at its glory, gruesome, grotesque best, you know. And then we opened up also for the Beach Boys, the time when the Beach Boys had that big, gigantic, honking sailboat stage that they were hauling around. That's the story, actually. We were opening up for the Beach Boys. We come into the place, and there's this big sailboat on the stage, right? They've taken all our gear and, like, pushed it up, like, we had about 5 feet in front of the deck, the bottom deck of the sailboat. And of course, the sailboat's, like, 30 feet tall, right? So you've got this big wooden wall going up behind you. You're like barnacles, you know? It was like Jeff Beck and the Barnacles. And we have no time for sound check, and we go out on the stage, right? And we play our sound check and go back to the hotel. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm hungry, you know? Playing, I'm, you know, my whiny, snotty-nosed little rock star worst. I need something to eat. So we were in Rochester, New York. That was the place. Rochester, you know, fairly far away from the ocean. And I go into the hotel restaurant. I have to get something. I look down the menu and I see, wow, crab Newberg. That looks great. I think I'm going to get some crab Newberg. Well, from the voice of experience, my friend, seafood is something that you want to eat close to the ocean, especially if it's crab. So we get to the gig, right? It's in this gigantic ice hockey stadium, and it's in the middle of hockey season, and so there's all this plywood down on this ice, and we're set up sort of about a third of the way down the hockey rink on one side, and then all of the other three quarters of the rink is where the audience is, and they're standing on this plywood, right? And stage is built up fairly high, and this gigantic huge sailboat is even higher, and so the Beach Boys are like way up there, like 75 feet above, you know, playing California Girls, 75 feet in this ice rink above this, in this hockey rink, surreal as you could imagine it could be. But in hockey rinks, there are these two doors, right? And one door is way down at one end of it, and then there's one door at the other end of the rink. That's the way they were back then, right? Two entrances onto the one door and one door. And so, and it's completely filled, I mean, jam-packed with these Beach Boy groupies. In every room, everywhere, it was filled with all these girls, all dressed so beautifully in these evening gowns and cocktail dresses and all, made up with makeup and every hair in place. Gorgeous women, you know, everywhere. And it's like, whoa, and why am I not appreciating this? And I start feeling like sort of a little uncomfortable, right? We get out, and the stage is built up like it's been on this platform about maybe 20 feet above the ice And with this one long stairway going up behind the sailboat and around to our 5 feet in front of the sailboat, but we're going to play this. So we're playing, and I'm feeling worse and worse and can't figure out what it is. You know, I feel sort of dizzy and cold, and I'm starting to sweat. And then all of a sudden, everything starts to localize down on my stomach. And I think, oh no, Crab Newberg. So I'm playing, and now I'm starting to get dizzy and starting to really sweat like a could just make it through the set, Steve, make it through the set. And there's all these people screaming and yelling, and they're so excited and happy, and I'm just feeling like horrible, right? But I managed to make it through the set, right? And I put the violin down really quick, run to the back of the stage, around the sailboat, down this long steps, and I get halfway down, and the road manager says, "Kindler, get back up here, we're doing an encore." So I drag myself up the steps again. Oh, no, I'm this time, you know, I'm feeling worse and worse by the second, right? Totally sweat, cold sweat, and just feeling like at any moment I'm going to pass out or something. I don't even really feel like I'm going to throw up yet. But I get up there, you know, and I see all these Beach Boy fans out in the audience, and we're halfway through this last tune, which was, I think it was Sophie. Da, 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 Sophie, right? Jamming, and everyone's jamming, having a good time. And then I just throw my violin down on the stage, just throw it down and run around the stage, run halfway down the steps and jump off down on the, I can still feel my feet hitting that plywood on that ice, clonk, and I just run like mad all the way across the remainder of this empty hockey rink to that one door, right? And I open that, get to the door, and I'm all dressed in white with this long, curly, long hair, you know. I throw open the door, and there facing me in this long hallway going back is completely jammed with these Beach Boy groupies. I look at them in horror, and they look back at me, the ones look back at me, and then comes out this Linda Blair like volcano of green 4 hour old Crab Newberg all over these Beach Boy groupies in the front row, and they scream and they turn and they run and smear it onto the girls behind them, and they run and scream, and then there's just like trampling each other, and all the while I'm following them down the hallway just vomiting out this continuous fire hose spew of green Crab Newberg. I make it to my dressing room and throw open the door and start vomiting all over the Heineken. And the road manager says, "Kindler, go to the bathroom." And so I go to the bathroom. I throw open the door, and there's all these guys crammed in there smoking pot, right? I was like, "Oh, no way." And I go and throw open the first stall, and there's these guys in there doing cocaine, doing a bunch of cocaine. Throw up the next one, there's guys in there doing cocaine in that one too, right? And I just vacate, and I spend the next, you know, however long it was, in agony, you know, driving the porcelain bus. And this, if you're ever in Rochester, my friend, avoid the Crab Newberg.
That's a great story, man. I could tell you, never eat seafood the further away you get from the ocean. Oh man, I really wish I had a picture of that whole scene. Steve goes on to tell me how he left Jan Hammer, went on to a solo career, and now he plays a 9-string violin.
I quit Jan's band in the early part of 1978, and then went from there, stayed in New York City for a year, and then got offered a job. My brother Bob told me to come out to Hawaii and live in Honolulu and play with the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra. And of course, a symphonic player and knew how to sight read and all that kind of stuff, and had those chops together. So I figured after 5 years, 6 years in New York City, that I was ready to experience a little different thing. And you know, looking back, that was also perhaps a huge mistake, depending on how you look at it. Of course, what are mistakes? We go through life and we have opportunities and we take advantage of them, and they all lead us into a greater understanding of ourselves and allow us the opportunity to learn, right? And so going back to Hawaii, I just learned different lessons than I would have learned had I stayed in New York City. And but I got to play with a lot of great players there. Leonard Panario, Shlomo Mintz came through, had a lot of great opportunities in classical music there. Because, you know, in Hawaii, when you're on tour as a classical musician, you've got these gigs in Australia and Japan, and you have to get from the States to there. And so everyone stops in Hawaii because they want to come to Hawaii and have a couple of days in the sun and play a concert. And then they go on from there to Japan or wherever in the Far East. And so all these great players would all be coming through and playing with the orchestra. And the orchestra there in Honolulu was very good. It was a really great orchestra. And so I had a place right on the point in Waimea. So I'd jump off the point, go and surf these monstrous waves and then during the day, and then come in and play in the orchestra at night. Right? So that was a pretty heroic life too, you know, playing, surfing like mad and all during the day, and then playing in the orchestra, playing, you know, sitting in it with a tuxedo on in the evening. That was fun. And I was composing and seriously interested. You know, I had some great mentors. Jan and John were both fantastic composers, and so I had it in my mind that I was also a pretty good composer. And so I always had this idea that I wanted to record my own albums and do that. And so it wasn't until 85, after marrying and having a child and, you know, going through life there in Hawaii, that I realized that I was getting rock fever, and I really had to leave the island. Maybe coming to Hawaii wasn't the best idea after all. And so I went to California and started recording there with Tisha Bell and recorded this album called Dolphin Smiles, which became a top 10 album in 1985 in the New Age music field. And so started playing New Age music at that point and got away from jazz and jazz rock and louder playing. But during that time, I also had this really great gig with a fantastic unsung jazz rock band called The Warriors, which had Joaquin Leavino playing guitar, who was late of Jean-Luc Ponty's band, and one of the great electric guitarists, Joaquin Leavino. I can't say enough of it. Like Doug Rauch, he's one of those very rare, individual, wonderful players. And he and Narda and Randy Jackson and Walter Afanasieff, who went on to be this fantastic producer. As John said about him, Narda was this guy who had all these fantastic ideas. He was just constantly so many ideas, an idea machine, you know, so creative that he had to go in that direction. Jazz rock wasn't big enough for him. He had to be in a situation where he could really exercise, spread his wings. And what better way to do that than being able to produce all these different artists and still be able to play drums? Narda is definitely a Renaissance man, no doubt about it. So I got to do an album with those guys, which was never released, unfortunately. I think maybe it's now released, The Warriors, with those five guys. And that was really great. That was jazz rock. I thought I'd heard everything when I played with Doug Rauch and Tony Smith, but once I got with Narda and Randy Jackson, he's another one of those bass players that is in that highest echelon of players. He was really innovative. But he and Narda together, God, what a sound. They were just so good, so locked in and so fat, so much groove and so tight. That was short-lived. Narda was, of course, too busy making money. Over here in Hungary, I'm currently playing with a Polish band. It's sort of a fusion, world fusion band called Virtual Art Orchestra, which is three people, Bogusław Ratz, who's a very fine, very diverse musician playing oud and electric guitar and 12-string guitar and saz and various other ethnic plucked instruments, and Daniel Mackiewicz, who's playing all different kinds of percussion, and of course I'm playing the 9-string violin. And we have an album that was released just recently called Atmosphere. The 9-string violin has got a range that encompasses all of the stringed instruments. It goes from low E flat, which is a half step below an upright bass, all the way through cello and viola and violin in fifths, and all the way to piccolo violin, a string above the violin. And so it has this tremendous range and capacity, and it's really a unique sound. And I feel like when I play it, I can I can pretty much strike gold wherever I sink the shovel in, you know. I know it's the same scale as a violin. That's one of the really amazing things about it. It's no bigger than a violin, but it's able to strike these really low notes. The string technology, you know, they have these strings now that have a very dense core, and then it's wound like a regular guitar or bass string, flat wound. But it's got this really dense core, so it can support that low note without flapping around a lot or going out of tune, you know. Wow. But the guy who made it, John Jordan, the luthier in California, came out of his shop and handed it to me and said, "Here, see, this violin was made for you." Because I'm, you know, a fairly tall guy and I've got big hands and fairly wide fingerboard, so I can get around on it, actually dig into it the way you have to. And on the low end, you have to really play it like a bass. You stay farther away from the bridge and you have to put more pressure on it and use less bow. And up through the cello register, it's the same thing, less bow and a little closer to the bridge. And then viola and violin, it's more like the technique of a violin. And then up in the piccolo violin range, you have to be very delicate and you can't play it too hard. So it's very interesting the way you're combining these various techniques of the various instruments so that the thing will speak the way you want it to. And then the pluck, if you get the right EQ setting on it, you know, you get a preset with some compression and some heavy bass EQ on the thing, and you can really make a very believable upright bass sound on it by plucking, by using it pizzicato, as the classical guys would say. So that's fun to be able to do, too, to play bass on the instrument. One moment playing bass and the next moment taking over and playing solos on it, or even playing rhythm chords like a guitar would play, because it's got the range. The only problem is it's got 9 strings. The problem is I only have 4 fingers still.
Steve was a great interview. I really felt a connection with him. In fact, I'm working with him on a new project that I'm producing, and he's going to guest solo on violin. So here's a new track from Steve and his band called Firestorm. It's killer. Check it out. We'll be right back.
this is Steve Kindler, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, the best instrumental music on the Florida Space Coast.
Thank you.